This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Huhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
This force is not an intervention force. It is there to protect innocent civilians, to protect people's access to and egress from Juba, and to be able to permit the people working on the issue of peace and its implementation to be able to move around without fear or interference.
That's U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry speaking today in Nairobi about a U.N. military force in South Sudan. Details coming up.
Also, at least 27 people are dead in yesterday's car and truck bomb attack in the Somali city of Galkayo. And the International Criminal Court holds a landmark trial on making destruction of historic and cultural sites a war crime.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has called for deployment of a protection force to help stabilize South Sudan. Kerry also warned that U.S. aid to South Sudan could be cut off unless leaders there take steps to stabilize the conflict-ridden country. VOA's Jill Craig has more from Nairobi.
South Sudan was at the top of the agenda Monday as Kerry met with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and foreign ministers from Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, Somalia, and South Sudan in Nairobi at the start of a three-country tour. Speaking to reporters, the Secretary of State announced the United States would be giving $138 million in new aid to South Sudan, which he said would be used for food, water, and medicine for those in need. He also issued a warning to that country's leadership.
But I want to make this clear, and I particularly think it's important for the people back home who are engaged in trying to help. I'm talking about our taxpayers in the United States. We made it crystal clear that this is not forever. We're not just going to fill in a void. We're not just going to provide help incessantly. If they're not willing to accept responsibility and do the things necessary to deliver to their people. That message was delivered loud and clear today.
Kerry also said it is urgent to deploy the 4,000-troop Regional Protection Force in South Sudan, recently authorized by the UN Security Council. President Kenyatta thanked the U.S. government for sponsoring that resolution. The U.S. proposed the force after clashes in South Sudan's capital last month killed some 300 people and prompted opposition leader Riek Machar to flee the country.
And let me emphasize, this is not an intervention force. This is a protection force with a very clear mandate to be able to protect people for their access, their freedom of movement, and their ability to remain free from attack or ambush from any source whatsoever. It is supplementary to the sovereignty and the efforts of South Sudan itself. And I think we had a good clearing of the air today in the discussion that we had with the participants on this subject.
Kerry also announced the United States would be giving an additional $117 million to support refugees, returnees, and drought victims in Somalia. He said another $29 million will be donated to the UN Refugee Agency for the safe and voluntary return of Somali refugees in Kenya, primarily from the sprawling Dadaab camp. Following an earlier closed-door meeting, a Kenyatta statement expressed hope Somalia will abide by its presidential election calendar, with polls scheduled for October 30th. He also noted the importance of building capacity within the Somali National Army, as the African Union plans to draw down its mission in Somalia by 2018. Kerry noted he and Kenyatta discussed the importance of preparations for Kenya's 2017 national elections and said the United States is investing more than $25 million to support that electoral process.
I'm pleased to see that progress is being made in reforming the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission. And I urge in the most emphatic terms that disagreements about policy and process be resolved through peaceful means. Kenya has come a long way since the elections of 2007. It is up to leaders on all sides to ensure that the violence that took place in the aftermath of that election is never repeated.
Later in the day, Kerry met with participants in the Young African Leaders Initiative and the Mandela Washington Fellows programs. Kerry will next travel to Nigeria and then Saudi Arabia. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
The death toll in yesterday's car and truck bomb attacks in the Somali city of Galkoyo rose to at least 27 today. A doctor at Galkayo Hospital says the number of fatalities is expected to rise. At least 90 people were injured in the attacks, some seriously. Witnesses say Al-Shabaab attackers detonated the bombs near local government offices and a nearby market. Galkayo is in the semi-autonomous Puntland region of northern Somalia.
Italian authorities are investigating an attack over the weekend by three Italian men on four Egyptian migrants near a migrant reception center in Sicily. The attack has left one of the migrants, a 16-year-old, near death in a coma. Authorities believe the attack could be linked to a criminal gang. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following the story. She spoke with me about the attack as well as the arrival of several hundred more migrants into Italy from weekend rescue operations.
Well, this is a really shocking attack. Three Italians apparently pulled up in two cars quite close to a migrant center that caters for minors and savagely attacked four Egyptian teenagers near this center in the Sicilian city of Catania. One of them was particularly severely injured, left in a coma, and has had surgery to remove bleeding from the brain and remains in a very serious condition. So media reports say that two cars pulled up, the Italian men jumped out and started attacking the teenagers who are believed to be aged 16 and 17, using baseball bats, and one of them even had a pistol, which later turned out to be fake, but was using the baseball bat and the pistol to attack these young kids. And this appears to be a premeditated attack. We're not sure yet what the true motive was, whether it was linked to a previous dispute. But what's also shocking is that the attackers themselves even used a cell phone to film the attack and also take photos. So quite a shocking occurrence, and certainly something that is of concern here to the police and other authorities who are trying to take care of migrants, particularly these young migrants who are only teenagers.
What type of investigation are the police conducting right now?
Well, police have arrested three young men from the area, three Italians. Two of them are brothers. They're facing various charges. But so far, the police haven't been able to reveal any details about the motivation for this attack, whether it was a dispute related to something that happened a few days ago in the marketplace in the city of Catania. It's not immediately clear, but it's certainly very shocking and something that is of concern to many people in Italy, not only those who are working to help migrants, but Italians across the country, I think, would be shocked to see this level of violence.
This brings to mind an attack that occurred against a Nigerian man not too long ago.
Yes, in July, Emmanuel Chidi Nnamdi died from injuries after he was attacked in the small town of Fermo in central Italy. His partner has now been granted refugee status in Italy, and we saw this huge outpouring of concern and sympathy from across the country, particularly because they had dreamed of building a life in Italy. The couple had arrived in Europe from Libya last year after fleeing the terrorist group Boko Haram in Nigeria. They had a very difficult journey through Libya and across the Mediterranean and were really being welcomed by a church community in the town of Fermo when that terrible fatal attack occurred.
Also, I understand that several hundred migrants have arrived in Italy in several rescue operations over the weekend.
Yes, authorities have been very busy for the past few days. We've seen around 2,300 migrants arrive off the coast of Sicily. Many of them have been rescued in operations conducted by the Italian Coast Guard and the Italian Navy and other vessels. So there's no slowdown in the numbers that seem to be arriving. And Italy has had more than 100,000 migrant arrivals just in 2016. And incidentally, there's a report that's come out today showing that if it wasn't for the migrants. By 2050, the Italian population would be falling to a lower level, losing around 10 million people if it wasn't for this influx of migrants that is boosting the population numbers.
What was the decline with the Italian population? What was that due to?
Italian population growth has been very slow. Italy has one of the lowest birth rates in Europe, so the numbers are not really increasing. Apart from this influx of migration that we've seen, that is of concern to authorities who want to ensure that there is worker population in the future, a tax base for the future as the population ages. And this country has one of the highest age ratios in Europe and one of the lowest birth rates. So it is looking to migration to boost the population numbers in the years ahead.
That was Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
A Malian jihadist has pleaded guilty to destroying cherished monuments in the Malian city of Timbuktu in the International Criminal Court's first ever cultural war crimes trial. From Paris, Lisa Bryant has more on the trial's opening in The Hague.
The court officer is now requested, pursuant to my directions on the conduct of the proceedings.
The trial at the International Criminal Court of Islamist Ahmad al-Faqi al-Mahdi is expected to last only a few days. That's because al-Mahdi has accepted the charges against him, directing 2002 attacks against 9 mausoleums and a mosque in the ancient Malian city of Timbuktu. Pleading guilty and reading out a statement at the trial's opening, translated here by an interpreter, he said he had been influenced by deviant groups and urged other Muslims not to follow his example.
Shukran jazila.
Thank you, Your Honour. I am really sorry. I am really remorseful and I regret all the damage that my actions have caused. I regret what I had caused to my family, my community in Timbuktu, what I had caused my home nation, Mali. And I am really remorseful about what I had caused the international community as a whole.
Al-Mahdi is accused of leading a vice squad organized by militant group Ansar Dine, which attacked and occupied Timbuktu, a renowned city of culture and learning and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. The radical group, with ties to Al-Qaeda, imposed a harsh form of Islamic law until French forces drove it out in 2013. The trial is the first time a defendant has pled guilty at the ICC and the first time the International Tribunal is holding a war crimes trial for destroying cultural monuments. Attacking Timbuktu's culture, Chief ICC Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda argued, is an attack on humanity.
Culture is who we are. Our ancestors created paintings, sculptures, mosques, temples, and other forms of cultural possessions all around us. They put their hearts and souls into the creation of such cultural heritage so that it represents the cultural identity of their times and is passed on for the benefit of future generations.
Bensouda stressed the broader implications of the landmark case at a time when radical groups are attacking ancient monuments and artifacts in places like Syria and Iraq. While welcoming the trial, rights groups say they regret charges against al-Mahdi were not broadened to include other crimes and that others involved in war crimes in Mali should also face justice. Al-Mahdi could face up to 30 years in prison, but prosecutors say they will seek a sentence of 9 to 11 years. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
19 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Egypt is negotiating with the International Monetary Fund for a $12 billion loan to boost its currency reserves. Egypt's reserves have dwindled to $15 billion. Mohamed Fayyash is former executive director of the IMF and former professor of economic development. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy about how the deal could affect Egypt's national debt, which now equals 98% of the country's gross domestic product.
It's basically a program for 3 years. And the intention is to deal with the economic imbalances right now. The budget deficit, the public debt, the exchange market. And to do a serious adjustment program, you need financing. So Egypt is coming to the fund basically to deal with these issues. Some of them are structural and they take time. I think the objective of the program to reduce the debt from the ratio now is about 98. So the intention to reduce debt over the 3 years to 88.
Egyptians are worried about strings attached to the IMF loan, such as devaluation of the Egyptian currency, more privatization, and less subsidies for the poor. What's your take on that?
Well, there is a conditionality in any program. They have to reduce the budget deficit, raise the interest rate, do something about the subsidies, energy and other subsidies, some structural reforms, do something about the foreign exchange market. These are the objectives. This, of course, in the short run, will raise the rate of inflation, which is about 13 or 14. To reduce public spending also will add to the inflationary pressures. But at least this is in the short run. But the answer of the fund and the Egyptian to that we will do something about the poor, the social network. Some of the money which will be saved as a result of these measures will be spent on the poor, whether in form of direct subsidies, food subsidies, or direct transfers, school lunch, medical expenses. This will be basically allocated to the poor. But no matter what, in the short run, there is a problem. And that's why most of the governments are afraid of taking these measures. It seems this time they're serious for reasons, I think. Some of the measures have been already taken place. For example, on the energy, reducing public spending, they already took place.
Final question. Judging from experience of troubled economies and countries with deep debts, what should Egypt do to get out of its economic troubles?
Historically, I can't remember any country made it just because of a fund program or bank program. But the program to be successful, there are conditions. If the program is homegrown, completely owned by the authorities, there is acceptance on the political and on the people's level. So the chances of the program will be much better. And there are other issues. I think in the case of Egypt now, it's not enough to either vote for the program or against the program. The question is, will this program lead, at least in the longer term, to a better economic management, or we will end up with higher costs for the poor and the middle class and more debt for the country in the long run? I think one of the issues now in Egypt, something has to be done about the political situation. There are issues which should be discussed openly. For example, the role of the government and the role of the state, what's the role of the private sector, the tax system, who will bear the burden, and the openness. Without reasonable, unified domestic front and security and political stability, it's very difficult to talk about attracting foreign direct investment or more money, because one of the objectives of the program is to catalyze more support from others. And the program should be discussed openly and explained to the people, why are we doing that?
Mohamed Faneish is a former executive director of the IMF and former professor of economic development. He spoke with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy.
On Monday, Cameroon marks 30 years since its worst natural disaster ever, a toxic gas explosion at Lake Nyos in the northwest that killed 2,000 people and 3,500 animals. The victims say they still have not received promised compensation. They also want to return to their homes, but the government says the lake is still toxic. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Nyos, Cameroon.
Lake Nyos and the surrounding land in northwest Cameroon appear to be completely dead. There is no sign of birds or other animals. The lake was the source of toxic gas 30 years ago that killed by suffocation some 2,000 people and 3,500 livestock animals within 25 kilometers of the lake. Magma under the lake leaks carbon dioxide into the water, and a large cloud of the deadly gas escaped into the air on August 21, 1986.
Welcome.
This camp, situated 25 kilometers from the lake, is now home to survivors. Papa Sabum lost his 30-year-old wife at the time and still has fresh memories of what happened to him and his neighbor, a commissioner of police.
I never saw her on the bed, but on the floor lying. I said, how? Why has this woman decided to take poison inside this house? Then from that time, I heard the wife of the commissioner saying, oh, my man is crying, my husband is...
Residents say when the incident happened, the government of Cameroon promised to assist them by building new houses and giving them money to do farming and raise animals. The survivors say since then they have been abandoned. 36-year-old Yusuf Musa says he can now read and write only because he walked 7 kilometers to the nearest school.
I was 6 years old when it occurred. I did my primary school studies here, and then there was no secondary school. I had to leave here and go to GBHS womb. That is 7 kilometers to and fro every day for 5 years. At times, I don't even have food to eat. And then I worked very hard to get my A-levels. So many of my classmates dropped out. I was fortunate.
Musa raises 9 goats behind his house to take care of his family. He remembers that his father lost 2 heads of cattle in the disaster.
Now we don't have animals, but while we were in Nyos, the cows were there.
But today, 9-year-old Aissatou Wilsa may not be that fortunate. She is unable to cover 7 kilometers to the nearest secondary school because of ill health, yet she has a dream.
I want to be a nurse if I have the means.
Besides education, food, electricity, and sanitation, the people say they are in need of adequate health facilities. It has always been the wish of the survivors to return to the villages they left 30 years ago. But Bita Benoit, an official of Cameroon's Ministry of Territorial Administration, says they still have to persevere.
Le danger qui planait dans cette zone.
He says the danger that Lake Nyos and its surrounding villages were exposed to is progressively being reduced because they are degassing the lake. He says it is only when the process is complete and they are sure of the people's safety and security that communities would be allowed to live in the zone. Benoit refused to comment on the compensation program for the survivors and their children. The government of Cameroon and some well-wishers do visit the people occasionally to give food to the scores of survivors living in the camp. Camp leader, Teacher Ewi, says they prefer to be empowered instead of receiving donations each year on the anniversary of the toxic gas explosion.
Since you are here, you are a big journalist, I wish that you should transmit this to the government, that the government have abandoned us. They will come and give us some bag of rice here and oil to eat. Teach somebody how to catch a fish, not be giving him that fish. The government should give scholarship to students who want to study, and tomorrow they should come back and build this village. I'm not happy with the government.
The Cameroon government says in the 1980s, the population of Nyos was over 3,000 and growing fast as many people moved to the area for agriculture and cattle ranching. 30 years after the incident, the population is still estimated at several thousand, but they live far from the killer lake, even though some are ignoring warnings from the government and returning closer to the lake. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Nyos.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.